back up and ran through the tall woods at night. Far away she heard her car start.
My name is Nevaeh. I lost my foot in a lawnmower accident. Now I teach other children how to play safe. Kids shouldn't play near lawnmowers. Lawnmowers are very loud. The driver wouldn't be able to hear you if you were playing anywhere near. It's very important to be cautious.
Whatever game you play, play safe.
A message from the War Amps. Learn more at waramps.ca.
As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to spread, it is important to stay safe. Coronavirus is now in Canadian provinces and territories. By law, if you have traveled abroad recently, you must self-isolate. To do your part, stay home as much as possible and practice social distancing. Try to maintain at least 2 meters away from others. Encourage those who are sick or showing symptoms to self-isolate or to seek medical attention. As always, wash your hands frequently, avoid touching your face, and practice good respiratory etiquette by covering your coughs and sneezes. Clean regularly used surfaces. COVID-19 symptoms can mimic colds and flu and include fever, cough, and difficulty breathing. Infected individuals may also have mild symptoms or none at all. For up-to-date information, check reliable sources like your local health authority or the Public Health Agency of Canada.
Good morning, you are listening to CILU 102.7 FM. I'm Joshua with It's Pretty Trivial. Thanks for tuning in this morning. I am recording this Sunday night as always, but that is significant as today I went on a hike at Sleeping Giant with a bunch of friends. I'll say it didn't go 100% to plan, but I thought since I was there this weekend and joined the wildlife, thought I might do an episode on at least bits and pieces of the Sibley Peninsula. So, today's episode is going to be all about certain aspects of the peninsula. So without further ado, let's get going. We are going to start with the story of the world's richest silver mine, which is located on the Sibley Peninsula. What is this world's richest silver mine we speak of? This was the Silver Islet Mine. Its mine shaft was beneath the icy waters of Lake Superior, under billions of liters of water. It was on this tiny island in Lake Superior that turned into the world's richest silver mine. This mine had many challenges, however. For example, anyone that knows Lake Superior, lived in proximity to the lake, knows it's really unpredictable and really dangerous. It can be completely calm, then transform minutes later into the raging sea that makes even the most seasoned people and sailors queasy. The conditions made creating a 365-meter deep hole in the ground underneath the lake an incredibly difficult task. Additionally, for it to be operational, they would have to protect the small island itself and have pumps always running to clear the water constantly collecting in the bottom of the shaft. However, this task was not deemed worthwhile by the Montreal Mining Company, who originally owned the mine. However, they later sold it in 1870 to who? In 1870, they sold it to Alexander H. Sibley, the president of Silver Islet Mining Company. Little did the Montreal company know, they just lost their chance of operating one of the world's most successful silver mines. When considering the best plan of attack for protecting the mine from the storms of Lake Superior, it was important to consider all options. One engineer suggested building a wall 9 meters high around the 2,468 square meter island. It would have a cost of a hefty $2 million in 1870, which would be worth almost $37 million today. Someone else suggested building a system of smaller walls and pumps that would have only cost $1 million. However, both the options were incredibly expensive and neither could guarantee the islet would remain safe. Another plan came to fruition. Deciding on the plan to protect the islet was overwhelming for the Silver Islet Mining Company. It wasn't until William B. Frew became lead engineer that they had a clear direction. Frew's plan was to build a break wall to protect the islet and use pumps to keep water out of the mine shaft. It would only cost approximately $50,000 and require only 34 workers to set up and get the mine operational. To anyone in the mining industry, hearing that a mining company was trying to dig into the ground under a lake to harvest silver on a $50,000 budget with only 34 men sounded preposterous. Imagine the Canadian track and field teams running 400 meter relays around a 400 meter track. Picture that distance going straight down into the depths of Lake Superior. That's approximately how deep the mine shaft, 384 meters deep, is, and about how deep the miners had to travel into the ground every day. Even today, a mine of this size is considered quite substantial and requires lots of planning and advanced technology to ensure the safety of miners. The mine shaft got so deep that eventually the timber supports being used were unable to support the weight of the overhanging mass of rocks. Instead of loading the mine shaft with timber supports, Frew left a thick vein of silver running all the way down the mine shaft to take the load from the roof. It was a smart move because eventually they would be able to collect this vein of silver. Instead of paying more for supports, the support ended up paying them. Communication was another added obstacle for the mining community at Silver Islet. Today, just a matter of seconds to send a message. For the miners and the families at the time, though, mail was the only method of communication, therefore the only way to let far-off family members know that they were still alive. Since there were no roads that led to the community on shore, the only way mail could reach them was by boat or dog sled when the lake was frozen. As a result, delivery of mail was inconsistent and inconvenient, especially for Frew, who needed to stay in touch with Alexander H. Sibley to successfully operate the mine. This is because the Silver Islet Mining Company was based out of the States. Mail crossing the border had to first travel between the Pigeon River border crossing before eventually crossing into America. When labor issues caused the U.S. mail contractors to refuse to carry any mail designated for Canada, it led to a critical lack of communication between Frew and Sibley. Luckily, a deal was made and the transportation of mail became regulated at great expense to the mining company. Once mail did arrive, people knew it had come when Postmaster raised the Union Jack flag, whereas today people have instant notifications on phones. The next part we're going to talk about is the demise of this silver mine. Eventually, the mine's remote location brought operations to an end after 30 years of extracting silver from underneath the icy Lake Superior waters. Crucial shipment of coal was not delivered to the Silver Islet in time to keep the water pumps running, and because of this, the mine was reclaimed by Lake Superior. Although it has been closed for over 100 years, the onshore community at Silver Islet remains with some of the original miners' homes still standing. Some of these historic buildings have been renovated, and the shore is now lined with summer camps in the shadow of the sleeping giant that lays, protecting the sunken mine shaft. Today, the mine and areas of Silver Islet continue to intrigue visitors and enjoy recreational opportunities at Sleeping Giant Provincial Park. And in fact, without the Silver Islet mining operation, no roads would have been built out onto the Sibley Peninsula, where the Sleeping Giant Provincial Park may not have been the same today. Anyone that's visited the park knows how nice it is to be able to get in and out. A lot of the stuff I got to talk about this was from the Ontario Parks website, by a blog post by William Odes, a natural heritage educator at Sleeping Giant Provincial Park. This was one of the original settlements on the Sibley Peninsula. This is one of the things that helped start it become what it is. Now, we're going to move bases and talk about the park itself of Sleeping Giant Provincial Park. First off, asking what year the park was established in. It was established in 1944. It was named Sibley Provincial Park after Alexander Hamilton Sibley. Sibley was president of the Silver Islet Consolidated Mining Company that operated in the area from 1869 to 1884. In 1988, the name was changed to what it currently is now, which is what? Sleeping Giant Provincial Park. Sleeping Giant is the iconic landform. It resembles a giant that sleeps on its back when viewed across the landscape. The name change was meant to raise the profile of the park and clear up the modern misconception that Sleeping Giant is an island in Lake Superior. It's actually part of the Greater Sibley Peninsula within the park. And it's just out into Lake Superior. It looks like an island from some angles. So it's not actually an island. It just juts out from the actual Sibley Peninsula. In my opinion, it's a very beautiful park, especially if you get to go walk this peninsula. It's very beautiful. And I have done it myself. It's a park that I definitely suggest fans of hiking and biking and all things involving camping should go. The full history of Silver Islet and the Sibley Peninsula is shrouded in the legend of Alexander Hamilton Sibley and his wife Mary Louise. The actual lake at Sleeping Giant Provincial Park that many like to camp at and know and love was actually named after Sibley's wife, Mary Louise. They had their summer home at Silver Islet and President's Point. It's a mini peninsula of approximately 2 acres on a jut of land between the sandy beach and Camp Bay, with the Silver Islet mine site offshore and in constant view. Was named after the president, like I said, Sibley, who, believe it or not, was the son of Solomon Sibley, who was what? And whose brother was Henry Hastings Sibley, who was also prominent. For which reason? They're important there. Solomon Sibley, the father of Alexander Hamilton Sibley, was Detroit's first mayor And he was also the brother of Henry Hastings Sibley, who was Minnesota's first governor. After the days of the mine, once the local of soirees that welcomed investors and royalty from Europe and U.S., President's Point is now a family cottage where we can enjoy beauty, peace, quiet, sun, beach, sauna, more than 100 kilometers of fantastic hiking. Silver played a major role in the Aboriginal stories in the formation of Sleeping Giant. It was the first industry that opened the region for development. It's the richest vein of silver ever known. Small rock formation was built to 10 times its original size, with extensive cribbing and rock, while digging more than 1,000 feet down under the lake on 9 levels. It was in 1884 that the mine finally closed. The once bustling mining community of 480 miners and families dwindled after it closed, leaving behind the store, graveyard, and miners' buildings and homes. For a period in the early 1900s, Silver Islet would be a port of call for day visitors from the Lakehead and Lake Superior cruises on the way to Ile Royale. Gradually, it morphed into the off-grid cottage community it is now, around Lake Superior and surrounding Surprise Lake. The mine holdings estate gifted lands to the Ontario government and was established as a provincial park in 1944. The original President's Point burnt down. The President's Mansion, burnt down. It was a 21-room home built for A.H. Sibley, and it burned sometime in the 1930s. All that remains from that mining days of the President's Point is a President's Billiard Hall, known as Trelawney, now over 150 years old. The original pool table is housed in the Silver Islet store. This is the story of Silver Islet and how the original Silver Islet and basically the Sibley Peninsula started. This is just the tip of the iceberg. There's lots to know about this peninsula. However, I think we're going to take a quick musical break. When we come back, we might cover a little bit more of the peninsula itself, and we might cover a little bit of another community on the peninsula. So stay tuned here on CILU 102.7 FM. Today we are going to talk about a mining song that actually will work pretty well with what we're talking about. It's about a mine disaster that happened in the 1930s. It is very widely recorded by Ewan McColl, and it talks about a mine that was closed in 1973. However, a commemorative service is held every year to commemorate those who were killed in the mining accident. The song is The Gresford Disaster by Ewan McColl here on CILU 102.7 FM.
You've heard of the Gresford Disaster and the terrible price that was paid. 262 colliers were lost, and 3 men of the rescue brigade. It occurred in the month of September, at 3 in the morning that pit was rocked by a violent explosion, dear God, in the Dennis where gas lay so thick. Well, the gas in the downstate section, it was packed there like snow in a drift. And many a man had to leave the coal face before he had worked out his shift. A fortnight before the explosion, to the shot firer Tom Linson cried, "If you fire that shot, we'll be all blown to hell." And no one could say that he lied. The foreman reports they are missing, the records of 42 days. And the colliery manager had them destroyed to cover his criminal ways. But the Lord Mayor of London's collecting to help all our children in waves. And the owners have sent some white lilies, dear God, to pay for the poor collier's lies. Well, down in the pits they are lying. They died for 9 shillings a day. They worked out their shift, and now they must lie in the darkness until Judgment Day. Farewell to our wives and our children. Farewell to our comrades as well. And don't send your sons down the dark, dreary pits. They'll be damned like the sinners in hell.
Welcome back. You're listening to CILU 102.7 FM. For the break, I said that was Ewan McCall. I was mistaken. I believe it's actually Stuart Cameron with the Gresford disaster. We were talking before the break a little bit about the story and about Alexander Hamilton Sibley and the Silver Islet Mine, and a little bit about the Park of Sleeping Giant itself. I think now's actually a good time to look at the Sleeping Giant and some of the legends with it, with Aboriginals. Now, these legends are legends about the Sleeping Giant and a lot of the bays themselves. In the Ojibwe culture, the Ojibwe legend identifies the giant as Nenebiju, the spirit of the deep sea water, which turned to stone when the secret location of a rich silver mine, now known as Silver Islet, was disclosed to white men. It is a really interesting story. This story basically arises that there is a spirit, that the Sleeping Giant was an actual thing, an actual person, or an actual giant that got turned to stone. Now, this history that human habitation happened here over 9,000 years ago. Now, that is where some of these legends come from. So, Nenebiju goes as the following. Standing on the shores of Thunder Bay, at the head of the Great Lake Superior, one can perceive, on looking across the waters of Thunder Bay, a great land formation situated directly on the mouth of the bay. Requires no imagination to see the form resembles the sleeping body of a giant, arms folded across his massive chest as in majesty of death. Mystery and legend surround the origin of this strange phenomenon of nature, and down to the ages, the following stories seem to have survived. On the island just outside Thunder Bay, known as Ile Royale, once lived a great tribe of Ojibwe natives. Because of their loyalty to the gods and their peaceful and industrious mode of living, Nana Bijou, the spirit of the deep water sea, decided to reward them. One day he called their chief to his great thunder temple on the mountain and warned that if he told the secret to the white man, that he, Nana Bijou, would be turned into stone and the Ojibwe tribe perish. The chief gave his promise, and Nana Bijou told him of the rich silver mine, now known as Silver Islet. The Great Spirit told him to go to the highest point on Thunder Cape, and there he would find the entrance to a tunnel that would lead him to the center of the mine. Apparently the chief and his people found the mine, for the Ojibwe become famous for their beautiful silver ornaments. So beautiful indeed were they that when the Sioux warriors, on seeing them upon their wounded enemies, strove to wrest their secret from them. However, torture and even death failed to make the gallant Ojibwe divulge the secret, and the Sioux chieftains had to devise another scheme to find out the source of the Ojibwe silver. One day, they summoned their most cunning scout to a powwow, and a plan was formed. The scout was to enter the Ojibwe camp disguised as one of them. This he did, and in a few days succeeding in learning the secret of the island of silver. Going to the mine at night, he took several large pieces of the precious metal in order to prove to his chieftain that he had fulfilled his mission. The scout, however, never returned to his camp. Far on his way back, he stopped at the white trader's post to purchase some food. Having no furs or money with which to pay for the goods, he used a piece of silver. Upon seeing such a large piece of gleaming metal, two white men sought to obtain the whereabouts of its source in order to make themselves fabulously rich. After filling the Sioux scout with liquor, they persuaded him to show them the way to the mine. When almost in sight of Silver Islet, a terrific storm broke out over the cape. The white men were drowned, and the native was found in a crazed condition, floating aimlessly in his canoe. But the most extraordinary thing that had happened during the storm was that where once was a wide opening to the bay, now lay what appeared to be a great sleeping figure of a man. The Great Spirit warning had been fulfilled, and he had been turned to stone. On a little island at the foot of the sleeping giant can still be seen the partly submerged shaft of which was once the world's richest silver mine in the northwest. White men have tried again and again to pump the water that keeps flooding it from Lake Superior, but without success. Still under the curse of Nana Bijou, spirit of the deep water, perhaps, who can tell? There are numerous legends, and one is not necessarily more valid than the other. The particular one I just read was in a book titled Tales of the Tom Tom, written in probably the 1950s or 60s by Hubert Limbrick, a former Fort William city councillor. Actual Ojibwe legends are stories about Nana Bijou printed in local 19th century newspapers. These stories reportedly came directly from Ojibwe elders interviewed at the time, but there's no way of verifying that today. The earliest dates back to 1882, while another version dates back from somewhat later. The versions are completely different from what Limbrick's rather simplistic and fanciful one, and neither makes direct mention of the sleeping giant. They talk about how Nana Bijou created the world, including the lakes, rivers, and islands. Limerick's story seems to be connected with Silver Islet and, as such, must be relatively recent origin as the mine was not discovered until the late 19th century. There's also a version in W.S. Piper's The Eagle of Thunder Cape from 1924 that mentions the creation of the sleeping giant, but also bears no resemblance to Limerick's. A lot of this info I'm getting is from the Northern Ontario Travel website. Moral of the story is that the sleeping giant has many, many stories of origin. However, a lot of them reference Thunder Cape or Thunder or the sleeping giant, Nana Bijou, and Silver. The actual story of Nana Bijou I have heard. Now, this is coming from, I believe this is a story I read in the provincial park, but how accurate it is. It involved, I believe, a thunderbird and the mountain. However, I will try and find that story after we take a quick break and hear from our sponsors here on CILU 102.7 FM.
CILU is sponsored in part by the students of Lakehead University, our listeners, and our sponsors. At this time, we would like to thank the following sponsors for their continuous support.
Lakehead Unitarian Fellowship, an inclusive spiritual community promoting a compassionate, just, and sustainable world. Find them online at luf.ca, on Facebook, or at 129 South Algoma, Sundays at 10:30 a.m. The Live from the Rock Folk Festival, bringing the spirit of folk and folk music to Red Rock every August. Keep up to date with upcoming happenings and buy tickets online at livefromtherockfolkfestival.com. The Outpost, Lakehead University's pub, full-service restaurant, and live music venue. Find them on Facebook to stay up to date all the happenings during the school year, like Tanker Tuesdays and Pub Night Thursdays.
Welcome back. You're listening to CILU 102.7 FM. I'm Joshua with the second half of It's Pretty Trivial. If you're just joining us, thank you. If you join us before, welcome back. Before, we were talking about Sleeping Giant, Silver Islet, and the story of the Sibley Peninsula. The Sleeping Giant has been one of our main themes, and so has the Silver Islet Mine, as the two are almost interlinked. I want to cover just one or two small things about it, and then I want to move on to another community that's based on the peninsula. Hopefully we'll have a couple more songs, and then we'll round out the episode. For the break, I was mentioning how there was multiple different stories of Nana Bijou. However, as far as I can tell, one of the main legends is the popular one is the one I mentioned before, when Nana Bijou was protecting the treasure of the sleeping giant. However, I also heard a story with a thunderbird. However, I'm not sure how accurate that is. And I believe I saw it in the park at one time, many years ago. So it's possible it's not. However, it's a very, very fascinating landmass. And one that is beloved by all. Many people love to take pictures and climb this beautiful, beautiful mountain with picturesque views and very steep cliffs. This mountain is over how many feet tall? How many feet tall is the Sleeping Giant at its highest point? Well, it turns out that the Sleeping Giant's height is actually over 1,000 feet. It's actually 563 meters tall. This is about, I'm not sure in feet, but I can figure it out for you. In feet, it would be 1,847 feet and just over an inch. 563 meters. That is how high the Sleeping Giant is. Now, another interesting fact is that the Sleeping Giant is one of the highest in Ontario, I believe. In Ontario, there's only one or two ridges higher, which is the Ith Panna Ridge, the Maple Mountain, and the Tip Top Mountain. that are just over 690 meters and 640 meters. However, I believe the highest cliffs belong to the Sleeping Giant. Sleeping Giant has some of the highest in Ontario at over 250 meters for some of the cliffs. And the highest elevation is actually on the torso of the Sleeping Giant. The highest point on the Sleeping Giant is, according to this, on the torso. The other community on the Sibili Peninsula is Pass Lake, which was a little community established in 1924 when there was a big Danish settlement moving to Canada. This is according to the government website. It is very much a community that is very Danish. Most of the Danes immigrated to Canada in the 1950s, with 1957 being the biggest year. 7,790 immigrants came from Denmark in 1957. Compares with 4,621 in 1951, between 3,000 or 4,000 in 1928 and 1921, as well as 1956. After World War II, less than 2,000 Danes immigrated to Canada per year. 1968 was the last year with over 1,000 Danes coming. 1984, the amount of Danes immigrating dropped to less than 100 per year, which continues. In the 1920s, the Danish immigrants came to Canada by ship. They could board the SS Frederick VIII, the SS Helig Olav, the SS Oscar II, and the SS United States in Copenhagen, and sail directly to Halifax. The ships were operated by the Scandinavia America Line, which was owned by DFDS of Copenhagen. Due to the Great Depression, the line was disbanded in 1935 and all four ships were scrapped. Out of the Second World War, Danish immigrants could sail from Scandinavia, including Copenhagen, with the Swedish America Line or the Norwegian America Line, which both called at Halifax. Another was the Polish liner MS Battery, which sailed to Montreal and Halifax in winter. 1971 is often referred to as the year in which more immigrants came to Canada by air than by sea. The Danes who came to Canada by ship can tell both wonderful and terrifying stories of the voyage. Many also remembered their arrival at Pier 21 in Halifax, being processed through immigration, and then boarding the trains from Montreal, Toronto, Winnipeg, points further west. The canteen at Pier 21 also had a special, a cardboard box containing the essentials for a long train journey, costing $2. Many will readily tell others of terrible conditions on the trains, wooden seats and little or no service, in addition to the desolate landscape looking out the window. Now, this was bad, but it eventually got better. For many years, Danes would call Canada home. And there was a lot of tough times for them. However, the story is pretty interesting. In the 1930s, Pass Lake became well known for strawberry crops. In 1935, it had over 20 acres of strawberries, which yielded 70,000 quarts of strawberries that were sold at markets. During the Second World War, Danish settlers in Pass Lake sold their land and moved away. Many of them did. However, new Danish immigrants started arriving and settling in Pass Lake during the 50s. Land clearing around Pass Lake began in 1924. In order to obtain the deed for their homestead, the settlers had to build a house and barn, clear and farm at least 2 acres of land during each of the first 3 years, had to live on the land at 6 months a year, and also obtain citizenship papers. Then after the 3 year period, they applied to get the deed to their homestead. They were required to work 3 days per year on the roads, but the reward for this was pay for 6 days of road work. Settlers would cut pulpwood in the wintertime for the provincial paper company, which was in Port Arthur, which is now Thunder Bay, and then clear land for the purpose of farming in the summer. Many Danish immigrants joined the settlers between 1926 and 1930. They eked out a living by selling wood products such as pulpwood, lumber, firewood, railroad ties, fence posts, until the land was cleared for farming. Around 1930, enough had been done and farming began. Cream was shipped to the city, potatoes and other garden produce began to be sold on the commercial scale. This is another little community that is on the Sibley Peninsula. It is a pretty cool story, in my opinion, that a little community, Northern Ontario, is a big Danish settlement for Canadian Danes. It's a nice little spot, especially for, you know, a half-day hike, or just to go out and see some nice water. However, I do believe it's kind of a paid camping community. But the community itself, up until recently, had a church, which recently burned down. Well, they also kept historical records. And as much as the actual lake itself is more of a camp than a lake, there is many off-roads, roads off the main highway, that will lead you into farms and kind of housing areas where many people live and still do to this day. My friend, who is of Danish descent, says that there's kind of a story that there's a name so common that if you say it in Pass Lake, almost anyone will respond to you, as it's so common. That is Pass Lake. For those who have not visited these places, I really suggest you take a look. The picturesque trails at Sleeping Giant and the beautiful scenery on your way through Pass Lake. It is really a sight to behold. I think we're going to take a quick musical break. When we come back, we will stop talking about the Sleeping Giant, and we will talk about something else for the last few minutes of the show. So please stay tuned here on CILU 102.7 FM. This next song is a song with a very familiar artist to, I'm sure, more than a few of you. It talks about mountains in Colorado. And however, it isn't in Thunder Bay, but I think as our talk of the Sleeping Giant, which is a big mountain itself, we might as well play a song about mountains. So without further ado, here is John Denver with Rocky Mountain High on CILU 102.7 FM.
Yesterday behind him, you might say he was born again. You might say they try to tear the mountains down to bring in a couple more people, more scars upon the land. The Colorado Rocky Mountain High, I've seen it raining fire in the sky. No, he'd be poor man if he never saw an eagle fly.
Welcome back. You are listening to CILU 102.7 FM. You're listening to It's Pretty Trivial with me, Joshua. That was Ain't No Mountain, or sorry, Rocky Mountain High by John Denver. If you are just joining us now, thank you. If you joined us in the first half, to recap, we talked about Silver Islet, Sleeping Giant, and then just some general facts about the Sibley Peninsula itself. However, we got a few minutes left, and we've more or less exhausted all those facts. So I think it's good to take a look at how some of these mountains are formed, and how many actual, you know, city, many land masses and lakes are actually formed. I think that will be a good thing to cover before we end today's episode. Now, there's different ways that a mountain can be formed. However, the world's tallest ranges form when pieces of Earth's crust, called plates, smash against each other in a process called what? And they buckle up like a hood of a car in a head-on collision. Process is called plate tectonics. The Himalayas in Asia, formed from one such wreck, started about 55 million years ago. 30 of the world's highest mountains are in the Himalayas. Summit of Mount Everest is the highest point on Earth. The tallest mountain measured from top to bottom is Mount Kea, an active volcano on the island of Hawaii in the Pacific Ocean. Measured from its base, Mauna Kea stands 33,474 feet, or 10,203 meters tall, though it only rises 13,796 feet, 4,205 meters above the sea. Volcanic mountains form when molten rock from deep inside the earth erupts through the crust and piles up on itself. The islands of Hawaii were formed by undersea volcanoes, and the islands seen above water today are the remaining volcano tops. Well-known volcanoes on land include Mount St. Helens in Washington State and Mount Fuji in Japan. Sometimes volcanic eruptions break down mountains instead of building them up, like in the 1980 eruption that blew the top off of, I believe it's Mount Fuji. Give me a second here. Yes. Sorry, Mount St. Helens in 1980. When magma pushes a crust up but hardens before erupting to the surface, it forms so-called dome mountains. Wind and rain pummel the domes, sculpting peaks and valleys. Examples include the Black Hills of South Dakota and the Adirondack Mountains of New York. Plateau mountains are similar to dome mountains, but form as colliding tectonic plates push up to land without folding or faulting. They're then shaped by weathering and erosions. Other types of mountains form when stresses within and between the tectonics plates lead to cracking and faulting of the Earth's surface, which forces blocks of rocks up and down. Example of fault block mountains include the Sierra Nevada in California and Nevada, the Tetons in Wyoming, and the Harz Mountains in Germany. That's how most mountains are formed. However, there's also, I believe glaciers can play a part in forming mountains. This is when basically they're the result of erosion of existing elevated areas, which are residual mountains. They're also called denudations. Examples include the Rhodopes, the Rila Rhodop Mountain Massive, which is the oldest landmass on the Balkan Peninsula, the Scottish Highlands, Scandinavian Mountains, and the Snowdonia in Wales. Those are examples of the residual mountains. There's also uplifted passive margins. And this is like the Scandinavian mountains, eastern Greenland, and the Brazilian highlands. The different elevated passive continental margins most likely share the same mechanism of uplift. It's possibly related to far-field stresses in the Earth's lithosphere. According to this view, elevated passively margins can be linked to giant anticlinal lithosphere folds, where folding is caused by horizontal compression acting on the thin and thick crust transitional zone. Basically, I believe it just pushes up lots of mountain. That is more or less how it is formed. I believe a lot of the mountains in this area are formed by residual mountains. I believe a lot of them were formed when the glaciers came through this region millions of years ago. They kind of carved their way through. In a documentary I saw semi-recently also showed how Lake Superior was likely formed by the same thing. There was very much likely a small, thin little river that what happened was start to get, with the glaciers, erode away the sand and dirt and silt. And slowly but surely, those little rivers turned into big lakes that filled when the glaciers melted. And that formed the Great Lakes we know today. I think that about does it for today's episode. Before we go, I'd just like to put on one last song. Today I feel like would be a good day to play a song by a local artist. So, this local artist has made a few hits. However, his big hit is what I'm going to play for you today. This hit is Two Heads, which is by Coleman Hell. So here it is on CILU 102.7 FM. I'll see you all next week.
There must be something in the water, and there must be something about your daughter. She said, I love you nothing but a monster. My love ain't nothing but a monster with two heads. I turn to you, you're all I see. I love a monster with two heads and one heartbeat.
I turn to you. You're all I see. I love's a monster with two heads and one heartbeat. We just got caught up in the moment. Why don't you call me in the morning instead, before we turn into a monster? Before we turn into a monster with two heads. I hope to God I love you harder. I hope to God I love you longer. If only I could live forever. If only I could hold you longer. There must be something in the water. And there must be something about your daughter. She said, I love you nothing but a monster. And I love you nothing but a monster with two heads. Turn to you. You're all I see. I love's a monster with two heads and one heartbeat. I tell you. You're all I see. I love's a monster with two heads and one heartbeat. We just got caught up in the moment. Why don't you call me in the morning instead, before we turn into a monster? Before we turn into a monster with two heads. Well, I hope to God I love you harder. I hope to God I love you longer. If only I could live forever. If only I could hold you longer. Well, I hope to God I love you harder. I hope to God I love you longer. If only I could live forever. If only I could hold you longer.
As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to spread, it is important to stay safe. Coronavirus is now in Canadian provinces and territories. By law, if you have traveled abroad recently, you must self-isolate. To do your part, stay home as much as possible and practice social distancing. Try to maintain at least 2 meters away from others. Encourage those who are sick or showing symptoms to self-isolate or to seek medical attention. As always, wash your hands frequently, avoid touching your face, and practice good respiratory etiquette by covering your coughs and sneezes. Clean regularly used surfaces. COVID-19 symptoms can mimic colds and flu and include fever, cough, and difficulty breathing. Infected individuals may also have mild symptoms or none at all. For up-to-date information, check reliable sources like your local health authority or the Public Health Agency of Canada.
CILU is sponsored in part by the students of Lakehead University, our listeners, and our sponsors. At this time, we would like to thank the following sponsors for their continuous support.
The Thunder Bay Country Market, keeping it local every Saturday from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m.